It was good to see the chamber leadership up in Washington in May, but of course there's no substitute for coming back home to Texas. And believe me, there's no place I'd rather be than here today and out of Washington, D.C., to tell you the truth. Well, we know there's a lot happening here in Bryan College Station. The Aggies have made their big move to the SEC. And on a sadder note, Steve Ogden, a great public servant and Texas senator, is retiring after 21 years of service in the Texas legislature. I think it's important to note that Steve helped write many of the budgets for state government, which showed a commitment to fiscal discipline, something we would like to see a little more of in Washington, D.C. As Steve said, Texas is a beacon state, and its fiscal policies are lighting the way for our nation. And I couldn't agree more. So I know we all wish him well. Well, let me start by saying a few things about what we have been experiencing in Texas in the last few months, and actually the last year, the historic drought and the devastating wildfires. As I was driving from Austin, we drove through Bastrop, and of course I'd been there just a few weeks ago to witness the destruction, but also the resilience of community spirit. They weren't waiting on Washington, D.C. to come along and bail them out. They were taking matters into their own hand, and sure, they're glad to get a little bit of help. But of course, these wildfires destroyed more than 1,500 homes. It's amazing driving through the woods and seeing three homes burned with only the fireplace remaining and a home untouched right across the street. But of course, we also saw the destruction of one of the jewels of our state park system, Bastrop State Park, which welcomes about 250,000 people a year. So far, 3.8 million acres of Texas have burned. That's an area the size of Connecticut. I know, which is hard to contemplate, certainly it's hard for people in other parts of the country to imagine. But of course, wildfires are just one part of another natural disaster we've been experiencing, that is the 100-year drought that is going on, which has been particularly hard on our farmers and ranchers. Texas got no significant rainfall in April or May, typically our wettest months. And then we had the hottest June on record. Believe it or not, the period of June, July, and August was the hottest period recovered in the United States of America ever. What does this historic heat and drought and these wildfires mean to Texas farmers and ranchers? Well, last month, the Texas AgriLife Extension Service projected that agriculture losses as a result of this record year were about $5.2 billion in losses. And I'm afraid I'm not going to deliver good news. I met with the Lampasas recently with some folks from the Farm Bureau, and the state climatologist was there. I think he's from Texas A&M, if I'm not mistaken, who said we could blame all of this on La Nina. And what he explained, we need a little more El Nino and a little less La Nina, because that meant La Nina makes it drier and hotter in the southern parts of the country and wetter and colder in the northern part. And unfortunately, it looks like we're going to have a dry fall too, he projected. Well, my goal, as Ron was kind enough to say in his introduction, my goal as your senator is to try to keep Washington from adding to the burdens that you have to bear if you're one of those people we're relying upon to create jobs and grow the economy and help us provide opportunities for hardworking Texans to provide for their families. As business leaders and job creators, I know you're concerned about taxes and spending and federal regulation. I share your concerns. But unfortunately, it seems that the White House is more interested in lecturing than listening or leading, frankly, when it comes to each of those subjects. A few weeks ago, you may have seen on television, the president asked the speaker to host a joint session of Congress to announce something that we frankly already knew, and that was that he thinks that another stimulus is a good idea, and so he wants more of it. That's what he announced. The president told us that night and told the country, as millions of Americans were watching, that we need to keep spending money that we don't have. 40 cents out of every dollar spent now by the federal government is borrowed money, adding to our annual deficits and our cumulative debt. And then the president told us we need to pass his jobs bill now. Pass this bill. You remember that? And he's all around the country giving that same speech. But according to the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Harry Reid, who's sort of the traffic cop on the Senate floor, he decides what bills come up and which ones will not. Well, Senator Reid says right now doesn't mean even this month. And recently he told, the president told supporters that he said, if you love me, you'll call your congressman and tell him to pass this bill. But it appears that even members of the president's own political party have lost that love and feeling when it comes to some of the president's policies. And it's really at this point an open question whether Senator Reid will bring that bill to the floor of the Senate. Well, we know the president has subsequently announced his new plan for deficit reduction. And it hadn't changed much either. Mostly tax increases, some budget gimmicks, and unfortunately, class warfare rhetoric. I pose higher taxes, particularly during a fragile economic recovery, on people we're depending on to create jobs and invest, because I believe, and I'm not Phil Graham, who was an economics professor, but even I, as a recovering lawyer, can tell you that if you want more of something, you don't tax it. You'll see less of it, not more of it. And we shouldn't raise taxes on activities and the very people we're depending on right now during this fragile economic recovery to create jobs. Well, the president came up with a new proposal in one sense. He called it the Buffett Rule, named after Warren Buffett, the super rich Nebraska, I think they call him the Oracle of Omaha. And I think actually, instead of the Buffett Rule, we ought to call the president's proposal the Buffett Minimum Tax. You remember, this is a little bit like the alternative minimum tax, which Congress created back in 1967. It was back in 1967 when Congress was told that there were about 155 high-income wage earners that were paying zero income tax. And so to tax those 155 high-income earners, the alternative minimum tax was passed. But we know today that that tax captures a whole lot more than just 155 of the super rich. Matter of fact, the Congressional Budget Office tells us that unless Congress acts, that tax will actually hit about 30 million middle-class taxpayers in 2012. So when somebody tells you we're just going to go after the fat cats and the super rich, put your hands on your wallet, because they may well be, probably will be coming after you. Well, regulation is another area that I know that is of concern to an awful lot of Texans as I travel the state and listen to their concerns. In Midland, I recently learned about a little lizard they call the sand dune lizard. It's about 5 inches long. Nobody really thought all that much about the sand dune lizard until the Fish and Wildlife Service said they were going to list it as an endangered species. Well, despite legitimate concerns about the facts, about the science, and the seriously erroneous assumptions, there is a lot that the federal regulators don't know about this little lizard. But Texans do know that if this lizard was to be listed as an endangered species, it would be a job killer for 27,000 Texans who earn their living in the Permian Basin in the oil and gas industry. Those are the counties, about 27 counties, that will be impacted by this designation if it were to finally go through. And that doesn't include the potential impact on the lizard habitat, because you can't protect the species, right, unless you protect the habitat where they grow. And Texas ranchers are particularly concerned about this because something called the Chenery Oak is something that these little lizards like. But it, unfortunately, it's poisonous to cattle and represents a death sentence on their way of life. And then we could turn to the Gulf of Mexico, where we all saw the tragedy of the Deepwater Horizon blowout and its aftermath. But we know that actually the federal government's response has been worse than the disaster when it comes to jobs in the oil and gas industry and production of American energy in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, the way I look at it is when we have a plane crash, it's a terrible event. But we don't have a moratorium on flying airplanes. We figure out what happened, what went wrong, and we fix it, and we get on down the road. Unfortunately, we saw an overreaction, in my view, in Washington, an overly broad moratorium in the Gulf of Mexico that ultimately had to be reversed by a federal judge. But that following that was a regulatory permitorium. In other words, the federal government drug its heels in issuing permits for drilling and exploration in the Gulf of Mexico. And of course, that resulted in the cancellation of a number of lease sales. And I've seen, and you've witnessed yourself, what the impact has been in terms of the Gulf of Mexico. I've flown out on a helicopter and stood on a drilling rig in 9,000 feet of water in the deep waters of the Gulf that was left idle by the moratorium. And I visited with at least one or more family-owned businesses that supply the oil and gas industry that provides, in this case, machine tools for the rigs. None of the people who work or live in the Gulf of Mexico, the people who would most immediately be affected, want to ever see anything like the Deepwater Horizon occur again. But none of them believes that we're going to improve offshore drilling safety by shutting down their industry and by seeing the rigs that would operate in the Gulf of Mexico move to other parts of the world and result in about 60,000 jobs being lost just in the Gulf of Mexico. And it's not going to make our planet any cleaner if these rigs move to other parts of the world that don't have our same environmental and regulatory laws. And as a result, we're going to see the United States continue to maintain its dependency for 60% of our oil and gas needs imported from abroad. So all Washington is doing is shipping jobs overseas and increasing global risk to our environment and maintaining our dependency on imported energy from parts of the world, in many instances, that are not our friends and whose interests are not aligned with ours. Well, the last example I want to mention is something that sounds a little arcane. It's called the cross-state air pollution rule. This is important because it affects our entire state. This is a new rule been proposed by the Environmental Protection Agency. But frankly, the biggest problem was that the state of Texas wasn't told ahead of time that we might be included in this new rule that goes into effect in January 2012, until just a few weeks ago. So we had no real opportunity to provide input, to challenge the computer models that the Environmental Protection Agency was using. But now it's put at risk hundreds of jobs, and as Trip Doggett, the head of ERCOT, who runs our electrical grid, if these new regulations had been put in place this summer when we had this historic heat wave, it would result in about 8.6% cut in our power generating capacity, resulting in rolling brownouts and blackouts, businesses forced to cut back, and ordinary Texans subjected to additional hardship. A few weeks ago, I was in Houston visiting with a bunch of seniors at a community center, and their concern about this rule was that these are folks living on a fixed income. And what this rule, if implemented, is going to make our electricity more expensive. And they were concerned about their ability to pay their heating and electricity bills and told me how much they had been struggling to deal with higher food and commodity prices anyway. But now this is an added burden for them. Well, the most insulting thing, I think, about this cross-state pollution rule is how the Environmental Protection Agency reacted when we said, hey, time out. We need a little more time. We weren't told ahead of time that we were going to be included in this rule. And we need an opportunity to question and challenge your computer models and provide additional input. One EPA official testified that the rule doesn't really take effect until on January of 2012, as the rule itself says it does, but rather they claimed it takes effect 14 months later, in March of 2013. They took that position because they said that's the date that compliance will be measured, not when the rule would actually require the changes. But according to Brian Shaw, head of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, he said the March 2013 date has nothing to do with how you're going to run a business. It's almost meaningless. Indeed, one of the owner of the coal-fired power plants that is affected most immediately by this rule has already announced they're going to lay off 500 employees, and that's just the start. So what's the alternative when it comes to taxing, spending, and regulation? Well, let me just give you a few suggestions. One alternative to higher rates on the people we're depending upon to create jobs and invest money is tax reform. I don't have to tell you that the tax code is hopelessly complex, and I don't know any person in their right mind that doesn't hire a lawyer or an accountant or maybe an army of them to help you just comply with the Internal Revenue Code. I believe, as the President's own Fiscal Commission reported, the Simpson-Bowles Commission in December 2010, that by taking a look at all the deductions and the tax provisions of our tax code, putting all of them on the table and eliminating or reducing them, we can lower it, we can flatten the tax, we can actually broaden the base, and we can generate more revenue when people will see their marginal tax rates lowered. We know that the United States has the second highest corporate tax rate in the world. That makes us less competitive. And so if we could take the corporate tax code, lower that rate, eliminate a lot of the so-called tax expenditures, we could make it more competitive for these multinational corporations based here in America to create jobs in America rather than do so overseas. There's another important reform that I think deserves your support, certainly has my support, and that is a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. Now, I don't think either political party can claim to be absolutely pure when it comes to spending. I hope my party has learned its lessons. I certainly think I have. But we need a balanced budget amendment to the United States Constitution. Right now the federal government spends 25% of our gross domestic product. But income, particularly during a recession and so many people out of work, is now 15%. And that 10% difference is the annual deficit, now roughly $1.5 trillion a year. And we know annual deficits add to the cumulative debt, which is now roughly $14.5 trillion. A balanced budget amendment with the appropriate safeguards in the case of national emergency, including war, I think is a responsible way to make the federal government to do what you have to do in your home or in your business, and which 49 states have to do, and that is simply to live within your means. There's some things we have to have, some things only the federal government can do when it comes to national security and infrastructure. But there's some things that we're spending money on in Washington that are duplicative and waste. Recently, the General Accounting Office came out with a report said there are 41 different job training programs, 41, that overlap and are hopelessly disorganized. And it's just a waste of money. Now, I support job training programs because I think in a dynamic economy like ours, we have to help people who are put out of work as the economy changes learn new skills so they can go back to work, particularly working in conjunction with community colleges and the employers in the community. But I think a balanced budget amendment is absolutely essential. The third and last thing I'll mention is our lack of national energy policy. You know, we need to make sure that we encourage, not discourage, private investment in the domestic and oil and gas energy. And I'm for an all of the above policy. I think we need nuclear, we need wind, we need solar, but we also need to be realistic about how much we depend. Right now, about 85% of our energy needs comes from fossil fuels, and that's not going to change a whole lot anytime real soon. But I do believe that particularly with the innovation and developments we've seen in our domestic energy production, that things like shale natural gas are something that we really wasn't possible a few years ago, and now it's created a huge job boom from East Texas and the Haynesville Shale to the Barnett Shale around Dallas-Fort Worth to the Eagle Ford Shale down in South Texas. And fracking, which apparently the Environmental Protection Agency has only heard about that recently, and now they've commissioned a two-year study to look into a practice that we've used safely here in Texas for 60 years, policed by local and state authorities like the Railroad Commission. And there has been no proven case, zero proven case of contamination of groundwater from fracking because of the practices of state and local regulatory agencies. So what do all these policies have in common? Well, they've all been tried here successfully in Texas. And they're all part of the reason why Texas continues to grow faster than the rest of the country. But we're not an island. We're not completely insulated by the bad practices and policies emanating from Washington, D.C. But I thought you'd like to hear some of my thoughts about how we can make things better and not worse when it comes to jobs and the economy. And now I'd like to hear some of your thoughts. So, Royce, with that, I'd be glad to answer or dodge maybe a couple of questions. And the judge is not running out because of my speech. He told me he has a docket, and so
thank you,
you're welcome. Right. You're welcome, Judge. Nice to see you.
I know there's questions out there. Don't be shy.
It's kind of a shy group, Royce.
Very often.
Take your best shot. You can talk about anything, whether I talked about it or not. Anything you have on your mind? Yes, sir.
Senator, you couldn't help but notice we have a large number of bankers here today. I think I can speak for all of us when I ask you a question. What can you do for us to get rid of Dodd-Frank, these new fair lending rules and regs, so that we can get back to the business of being community bankers?
You might repeat your question.
Sure. Well, the question was about banking regulation, particularly as it applies to community bankers. And let me just say that the community bankers were collateral damage in the effort to go after the Wall Street bankers that basically contributed to the fiscal crisis we got in 2008. And unfortunately, you all got caught up in that, and you didn't have a thing to do with putting us in that crisis. I think the problems we see now. First of all, we saw that when one party has all the power, that was voted on when my friends across the aisle, as we call the Democrats, had 60 votes in the Senate. They had the House majority and they had the White House, and they could basically do anything they wanted. And when it came to Dodd-Frank, they did. But the worst part of it is, as you know, it's not just the legislation, it's the regulators. And so in 2010, when the voters of the great state, or all of the great states across the country, issued a restraining order on the president's legislative agenda, what they couldn't stop is the regulatory overreach. I was visiting with a friend of mine I went to law school with in San Antonio recently. He has a little bank out in West Texas. He told me his compliance costs alone for his own little bank is about $1 million a year. So that's $1 million he has to spend not on loaning money the small businesses so you can create jobs, but he has to spend on complying with ever-increasing and burgeoning and burdensome regulation. That's one of the things that we need to, I think, exercise aggressive oversight on. Our friends in the House of Representatives, I think, are doing some of that, but my hope is that we'll get a few more reinforcements in the Senate in 2012, so we'll be able to do it ourselves, and if we're lucky, maybe we can begin to peel back some of the overregulation, which has hit Main Street when Main Street had nothing to do with this problem. It was some irresponsible actors in Wall Street.
The staff tells me we have time for one more easy question.
Yes, sir.
Senator, first of all, thank you for your
Thank you.
In the recent Republican debate, the question was asked, all of the candidates, what one government agency would you, as president, seek to eliminate? And Herman Cain answered the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. Good comments on this.
You know, when a federal agency goes away, that doesn't mean that regulation of that activity goes away, because we have the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality here in Texas that does, I think, a very good job and responsible job of making sure we have clean air and clean water. There's nobody I know of in their right mind who wants, you know, dirty air to breathe and dirty water to drink for themselves or their family. So in that sense, I think we are all environmentalists. But unfortunately, the EPA, I think, is just, it's a rogue agency. It's out of control. None of the regulations require, or they right now, they don't do any kind of cost-benefit analysis. It's almost like they're living in a parallel universe, passing more and more regulations without regard, frankly, to the sort of due diligence that you would use in your own business, and with questionable science. I think this morning, the Inspector General of the Environmental Protection Agency has said that regulations that the agency has issued to control greenhouse gases was done without adequate regard for the science, and indeed questioned the lack of peer review for some of the scientific bases upon which these new regulations were issued. So I think in a country as big as ours, where we have more than 300 million people, I always felt that local government is the most responsive, and by that I mean not just local, I mean state government, because they're closer to the problem, and they're also more responsive to the voters and to the people they work for. So I think if by that he means that there's a lot of things we're doing at the federal level that we could delegate without any real harm to the state, I agree with him. Thanks, Royce.
Thank you, sir.